When my great-grandparents were little kids, their families lived across the street from each other in Rockland. Now, since I already said they were my great-grandparents, you know a little bit about how this story ends. Obviously, they ended up together. But first, Nell moved away, not far, just a mile or so. But then Tyler's family moved all the way to Belfast. They were 15 in 1891. And though technology was definitely causing huge disruptions to the economy and reshaping everything about the way people lived, Belfast and Rockland were not exactly commutable back then. Yet, for these kids, they kind of were. Somehow, the two of them not only figured out how to keep in touch, they started meeting up regularly. Nell would ride a bike north, and Tyler pedaled south, and they would rendezvous at Duck Trap, and then each pedal home. And for those of you who like the numbers and want to know if that was fair, it's a 30-mile round trip for Nell and a little less than 22 for Tyler. So I'm a little curious about what that discrepancy means and how it came about. But the part of the story that gets me is not how they planned or how they found the time or whether their parents knew, although I do really wonder about these things. But what gets me is the idea of pedaling alone along Route 1, which at that point wasn't much more than a wagon trail. It didn't even begin to get paved until the 1920s. So what was that like to bike on? I picture those old bone shakers with the front tire about 5 feet high and then a tiny one in back. And I wonder how my Nana, who was so short that her kitchen was specially built with low counters, how did she get up on that seat, let alone ride for miles up the coast? And what were the tires like? I've seen some that are made from like flat wood, like 3-inch wide strip, and that seems like it would be painful. But wouldn't the kind that needed to be inflated simply get punctured every 5 feet? So whenever we're driving between these two towns now, as we did last Sunday and then again this morning, I stare out the window and my mind strips away what's actually there and leaves the 19th century buildings intact. It's harder to picture them as they were, though, you know, brand new and gleaming with fresh paint, instead of being weathered and timeless as they are now. And the trees that are huge now were either tiny or non-existent. Most of the woods were used up in the lime kilns back then. It's a funny act of simultaneous erasure and a kind of revealing, too. There are memories and history and stories and imagination all layered in. It's a peeling back that makes the landscape more real to me somehow. So why am I telling you all this? What does this story have to do with anything? I think it's my way of exploring the historical moment we occupy right now, and realizing that it's not unique. We are layered upon a past that has elements we might not see, stories that are hidden from view, but that shape us nonetheless. There's a wonderful Stanley Kunitz poem which contains the line, "Live in the layers, not on the litter." Embrace depth and richness of life rather than riding along on the surface, he says. I've walked through many lives, he writes, some of them my own. On the ride from Rockland to Belfast, I think of the lives that came before mine, the ones that brought me here, and I think of the road itself. How many feet, animals, native, settler, how many feet tramped out a path before wagon wheels shaped that path into a trail, which became a street, and then a thoroughfare, a state route being widened as we speak. In the locker room at the Y where I swim, some women were talking recently about how the country's going backwards, how we are poised to lose so much right now. And I do agree that we're at a really painful juncture, full of sadness and rage and fear and disbelief. But I do not believe we're going backwards, even though we've been here before. Literally, we were here 8 years ago, and 4 years ago, perhaps we thought we had vanquished this particular problem. We are living in the layers, engaged in struggles that are much deeper and longer lasting than we want to think about. Progress has never been linear or quick, let alone rational. Think of little Galileo, born with stars in his eyes, bringing the stars down to earth for others to see, and ending his days under house arrest because he understood the workings of the night sky and discovered that the earth orbited the sun and not the other way around. Centuries later, a spacecraft named Galileo was launched, and then, finally, after that, the scientist was pardoned, declared right after all. The past and the future are held in elliptical motion. Having decided to tell my little Rockland to Belfast family story, I did my research, and it turns out that by the time of my great-grandparents' romance, the bicycle, which had been an oddity throughout the 1880s, became, as we say, a thing. Engineering completely changed, and the kinds of bikes that we're used to now with two equal-sized tires and a diamond-shaped frame became the norm, so no bone shaker for my Nana. And the tires, which had been incredibly heavy and made from solid rubber, were switched out in favor of the kind we use now that are filled with air, so that your legs didn't have to work quite so hard. In other words, my great-grandparents were conducting their courtship because of a technological and manufacturing revolution. It was expensive. A used bike in 1895 cost about $35, which meant that a couple would need the equivalent of $2,500 today. But nevertheless, it completely changed what was possible for them. So at first, their story seems to be a personal one, a romance about passion and drive, or the refusal of children to be separated from what they knew to be their fate. And for me, perhaps it's a nostalgic story, looking backwards for connections and solidity, ties to the landscape and to characters who had will and determination. But maybe this story is also about freedom, and especially what freedom looks like in a rapidly shifting culture. In the 1890s, advertisers pushed the idea that success in bicycling meant success in life. Buying a bike was a way of getting ahead, of being ahead. Advocates talked about fresh air, an escape from the dirty and increasingly crowded cities, and above all, they promoted the sense of freedom, that feeling that you could fly. It was this incredible sense of escape in which you were both in charge of your own destiny and at the same time not really on this earth. Orbital, the novel I read from earlier, explores this same theme, how that whole push to the outer frontiers is part of that simple urge to feel free, to slip the bonds of gravity, feel you are flying above everything. The irony, of course, is that the factory work and engineering which made the modern bicycle possible was exactly what made people need to escape. Exactly why the cities were dirty and crowded, why time became mechanized and divorced from the sun and the seasons. I don't think I need to belabor the analogy to today, SpaceX and Blue Origin and Virgin Galactic, the projects of superstar billionaires, they will take other worthy and successful individuals on amazing adventures. They will help you colonize Mars so that you can ignore the living conditions on this planet. Big corporations and concentrated wealth control working and living conditions, and people perform tasks over and over for someone else's benefit. This is also part of the story of exploring without bonds, and it's missing when we equate beauty and freedom, when we think freedom means escaping the confines of Earth, the drudgery of daily life, and experiencing wonder and awe and nature on an ever-expanding canvas. Which we do need, that wonder, the vast sky. The first of the sources from which we draw our own religious tradition is direct experience of that transcending mystery and wonder which moves us to a renewal of the spirit. Reading about the sun rising and setting and the colors of the sky and the appearance of the clouds over the surface of the earth, all of this provided solace and perspective and comfort that I never get from reading the New York Times or watching the nightly news. But this is not freedom. It's nature and beauty and complexity. Perhaps it's a simple reminder to look up, to lift our eyes to the hills, to search the heavens, not to escape, but to find our place. One of the gifts Galileo bequeathed to us is the understanding that Earth is not the fixed center of the universe. We are but one planet orbiting in a vast solar system. That means part of our story is in space, too. That sky spattered with lights that invoke the great myths and legends, that tells us stories and helps us think about where we fit in the galaxy. And we know now that we are all actually made from exploding stars. The calcium in our bones, the iron in our blood, the nitrogen in our brains, it comes from space and stars. As the poet Nikita Gill wrote, we are all really stars that have people names. In orbital, six people from different countries with vastly different backgrounds and concerns come together and form a constellation. Despite all that makes each of them unique, they function collectively. They have to. Their survival is dependent upon this. And so even though they're individually grappling with their own versions of human fragility, with death and decay, there is a perspective that says wonder and beauty are enough to sustain us and will outlast us. They don't want to escape. They want real freedom, which is about having agency, having the right to exist and make choices and participate and have some power, to make a difference, to work with others and achieve something that matters. One of the things that I like about my great-grandparents' story is the self-determination it contains and the energy. I want to be like that, feisty and strong. But I also appreciate that this story is not just theirs. For women, bicycling was part of a much larger movement towards liberation. In order to ride a bike, clothing had to change. Bloomers became a symbol of female empowerment. Then bicycles meant that women could get outside, participate in society, interact with others in a less controlled way. They could travel without a chaperone. None of these things happened without pushback, a lot of it. And there was cultural warfare. But bicycles were never an escape from the issues of the day. They were a road in. They became a way to claim public space for women, and eventually they became a symbol of the suffragette movement. This definitely was not the intention of the engineers or the factory owners who churned out a product to sell. And truthfully, I have no idea if any of that was on my great-grandmother's radar either. She died before I was old enough to ask her about women's rights and voting. And that's something I think about too. We never know the consequences of an action or a decision ahead of time. We can't know who or what we will impact with the choices we make, with what might emerge from the work that we do. What it means to us might have nothing to do with its significance down the line. Telling stories from the past, peeling back the layers, allows us to recognize how much things have changed and remember that they can change. We gain a more complicated and accurate picture of life. We see that people have power. We have power. And there's a sense of connection, working with others, not only today, but over time. We are partners with people we barely remember or never knew, but together we do move forward. What are the stories that you pivot around? What are the stories that make you feel fully yourself while also sending you forth somehow more ready to soar? I loved the idea that the astronauts and cosmonauts in the reading this morning had this idea that from space it seemed like the Earth itself was heaven, that improbable and hard to believe in place, that if we're lucky, we would get to go there at the end of our days. What a wonderful reminder that we do not want to escape from this place or this moment. We want to fully inhabit it, bring our whole selves in so that we can transform it and make it feel like home, like our country, our planet. This sad and infuriating moment in our nation's history is not going to determine if we as a people are well or not. The work we need to do is the same. The life we need to live is the same. Maybe the question in life is not about what we accomplish or even about what anyone else does or doesn't do, but about who or what our stars are, what we orbit around. The astronauts are tethered to Earth. That's their center, and they encircle it over and over and hope to get back. What do you revolve around? What is it that centers you and sustains you and keeps you moving? Who are your stars? And who might be looking for your shiny presence in their night skies?